KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education in Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is May 28th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. It's Friday, and in case you need a reminder, Game of Thrones ends on Sunday. You know, I got a poll on my Twitter page, @AMartinezLA. The question is, who winds up on the Iron Throne? I've got Tyrion as a choice, Jon, Dany, and other. No one thinks the Mother of Dragons is going to be on the Iron Throne. So give it a vote, @AMartinezLA on Twitter. Now, before we get to the rest of your weekend, we got a lot of stuff on the show today, like...
There's a sense of liberation and optimism for the future. And so there's a certain exuberance that exists within culture and that's reflected in the architectures.
We'll take you on a tour of a mid-century modern Eichler home in the city of Orange. That's coming up in about 30 minutes. But first, it's State of Affairs, our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. Federal funding for California's high-speed rail has been canceled. A landmark housing bill was killed, essentially. But the governor is pushing for affordable health care for all. Let's jump right into it. And this week, we're joined by Zach Corser, visiting assistant professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. Hello, Zach.
Hey, happy Friday.
Also, Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico's California Playbook. Hello, Carla.
Hey, A, put me down as a vote for Tyrion.
Tyrion. Okay, you got Tyrion. Zach, you
want
to vote,
Tyrion.
Zach? You
got
to...
I'm embarrassed to say I'm not a watcher.
Not a watcher. Well, goodbye, Zach. Thanks for knowing. All right, let's start with President Trump. By way of the Federal Railroad Administration, he canceled the $929 million grant for construction of California's high-speed rail project in the Central Valley. Carla, what are they saying is the reason for that?
Well, you know, federal officials said that California has just repeatedly failed to make what they called reasonable progress on this very controversial project. And they have argued that the state cannot deliver the original vision that was agreed to years ago. In the words of the administrator of the Federal Railroad Administration, he said California hasn't demonstrated the ability to complete it, never mind deliver it by the end of 2022. But, you know, let's be real here. The funding has been an issue since California voters first approved the $10 billion in bonds back in 2008. And, you know, there's been cost overruns. There's been delays. The governor even acknowledged this. You had that in your opening when he gave his State of the State address in January. And he said there wasn't enough to building the whole project, that he'd have to concentrate on that leg in the Central Valley. And that sort of set Trump off on Twitter, basically threatening to pull all the funding and to see that the billions that California's gotten will be returned to the federal government. So, game on.
Well, let's get to that, because Federal Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao is looking to get back $2.5 billion more in grant money that the state already spent. Gavin Newsom says that Trump is, quote, trying to exact political retribution on the state and that it's California's money. Zach, technically, when the federal government awards a grant, whose money is it?
Well, it depends on the term of the grant. In this case, there was an agreement written between the state, the high-speed rail authority specifically, and the federal government, the federal rail agency, that basically put together the terms upon which these funds would be given to the state. And there were certain performative measures. And if you read the letter from yesterday that comes from the federal government, from the FRA, They kind of, you know, it's an indictment where they just kind of go down and say, you were supposed to match this kind of money. You were supposed to be this, you know, this far along in your project, and you've not met these measures. And so we're terminating our agreement. And I think it'll be tough for the state to make a lot of arguments because, I mean, you know, as was said, it's Newsom himself, I think, that started the last chapter of this when in his State of the State address, he said, you know, look, this has been a troubled project. He says he was concerned about extending it to San Francisco and to L.A. He said it would take too long and cost too much. He also complained that the whole process had too little oversight and not enough transparency. And so, you know, if you've got a federal government that's already fairly hostile to California, who are essentially not willing to work with you through, you know, refiguring this agreement out of 2010 and are going to hold you to the letter of that agreement, it looks really imperiled. The question, I think, legally and politically, is can the federal government actually claw back all the funds that California has already expended? I think that's a little more controversial and a little tougher for them to do.
So, Carla, what happens now? Because I smell a court battle. I mean, does this project continue in the meantime, or does California hit the snooze button on the high-speed rail?
Well, you know, it looks like nothing's going to change immediately, and those shovels are still going to be at work because Gavin Newsom this week was very strong. He basically said, see you in court. He called the administration's move illegal and a direct assault on California. He said we're going to vigorously defend against that. And remember, A, this is a battle that could go on for years, maybe until the next presidential election when maybe there could be a reset with a Democratic president. But in the meantime, look, this project is paid for by federal money, by bond dollars, by revenue from the state's cap and trade program. And so the estimates are that with some of this cap and trade money, the state could just cobble together enough money to complete at least that segment of the Central Valley that Gavin has talked about. So if cap and trade revenues are still on, you know, looking good, it looks like the project should be okay. At least that's what the administrators are telling us.
Zach, considering that California is positioning itself as one of President Trump's biggest foils, factoring in its goals on transportation and emissions, I got to ask if this is going to be a hill worth dying on issue for Gavin Newsom. And actually, should it be one of those?
Yeah, I think he might have bigger fish to fry moving forward. I don't know that Newsom. I mean, I think at this point it's a little bit about saving face. You know, he came out, I think, correctly and said in his State of the State, we need to rethink this project, both financially and in terms of the plan that's out there. But tempering this is a president and an administration that's pretty hostile to California and particularly on climate change. So legally, I don't know if this is really going to be a fight worth fighting because I don't think it's going to pan out. But, it, you know, you could drag this out, as was said, in the courts until another administration comes in and then see if you can renegotiate again. But I think the chances are slim.
We're talking State of Affairs, our weekly politics chat with Zach Corser and Carla Marinucci. Now, while President Trump wants to put a bullet in the bullet train, the state laid Senate Bill 50 to rest. Carla, remind us what Senator Scott Wiener's plan was all about.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to give Senator Wiener credit because everybody talks about California lacking housing, especially affordable housing in the urban areas. And his bill, SB 50, was his second attempt at what many saw as landmark legislation to address this issue. It was controversial. It was ambitious. Essentially, calling for loosening local control over zoning near public transit and job centers. And the idea to address affordable housing and reduce gridlock by increasing home building near mass transit centers, allowing, say, 4- and 5-story buildings and more homes on land zoned for single-family use. And, you know, that was the rub, because in a city like San Francisco, for example, 70% of the land is zoned single-family, and transit centers are everywhere, and that's where the resistance came from. A lot of people were very much opposed to this kind of denser housing in their neighborhoods.
Scott Wiener is a Democrat, but the fight over SB 50 revealed that just because California's a blue state, that doesn't mean every Dem will just get on board just because. Zach, what kinds of divisions have we seen here?
Well, it's interesting. I think Carla's right that really the core of the opposition came from cities where there are a lot of single family homeowners who are not for upzoning. And one of the biggest things that SB 50 would have done was essentially eliminated in certain areas of the state single family zoning where you could put up to a fourplex. And, you know, Senator Portantino, who is from La Cañada Flint Ridge and represents the foothill areas of the San Gabriel Valley, all of these cities, which are in a large population county, would have been affected by this measure. And these cities, I think, were almost unanimously against it. And you also saw that there were advocates for poorer neighborhoods who were concerned about the effects of gentrification. People who were advocates on behalf of affordable housing were saying that this is just a sop for developers, that this wasn't going to actually create much in the way of affordable housing, but it would create more development. But there were a surprising number of people who were on board. I mean, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that big cities, mayors were for it, San Francisco, Oakland, Sacramento, San Jose, the California Association of Realtors, California League of Conservation Voters, and polls that were taken statewide, 43% of Californians cite affordability as a top concern, and Governor Newsom has it as a top concern as well. And I think if you look at what's remaining right now in Sacramento in terms of measures to adequately address the depth of this problem, I think we need to go back to the drawing board and start thinking about what actually has some teeth to affect this problem. Because if SB 50 will not be talked about until 2020, It's a setback. I think it's a big setback.
Yeah, let's talk about Gavin Newsom's role or lack of a role in this, because he says he was disappointed, but he never publicly supported SB 50. So given that he's made housing affordability a top priority, Carla, what do you think he needs to do to get traction on this issue when it appears that all the political and economic incentives are on the side of keeping the status quo?
Yeah, you know, you have the mayors of three major cities yesterday, San Francisco, Sacramento, and Oakland, expressed a profound disappointment this didn't go anywhere. So there is some momentum on the other side. And these so-called, you know, YIMBY groups, or Yes in My Backyard groups, they want to push this forward. And Wiener said himself, he's not giving up. He's going to come back at it. But yeah, you're right. You know, the issue is, I think, that people are stuck in gridlock increasingly, and younger workers can't afford apartments or homes, and they have to live farther and farther from their workplace. That is on Wiener's side in this issue. But there's another timing issue that's not, and that is the next window for this bill comes in the beginning of January in 2020. And guess what's coming up 2 months later? The presidential primary election.
Yep.
So that doesn't do well for him in that respect.
All right, moving on now. Who doesn't love a road trip? That's what the governor's doing right now to get his message out there on health care. He's been all over Northern California, and today in L.A. talking about making it more affordable for young people.
We're about to do something no other state in America has done, and that's provide full coverage through our Medi-Cal system and make it available and accessible to people in your circumstances up to the age of 26, extend it from 18 to 26, regardless of your immigration status.
Carla, tell us why he feels the need to travel up and down the state for this.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think the governor knows that this issue is first on the agenda for a lot of voters. Something he's made central to the promise of his administration. He knows California is the most populous state and could set the agenda for the country on this. And a win here would be a win for Democrats in other parts of the country. So he rolled it out this week. I was in Sacramento when he did. And, you know, he was talking about what the Democratic presidential candidates need to do when they're talking about Medicare for All, that they have to appeal outside their base. They have to begin having these conversations with small business, other people who want to know how to pay for it. And that's why he's been traveling San Francisco. He's going to Los Angeles, San Diego. And in San Francisco, he did announce this week another major healthcare news issue, that three Bay Area counties, San Francisco, Alameda, and Santa Clara, all followed Los Angeles in joining his initiative, which is aimed at making the state the biggest single buyer of prescription medicines after Medicare and the VA. That is a very big issue, because the bigger the purchasing pool, the more leverage the state has in negotiating drug costs. You know, right now, we don't know, will this healthcare tour help the governor pull off his healthcare agenda? We'll see, and because some of it is quite vague, when you talk about the prescription pricing especially. But boy, people are watching this one, and people are looking ahead, obviously, at Gavin Newsom and his political future. If he gets this done, it is a big win for him and his party. But
all right, one more thing. In what could be a scene out of HBO's Veep, former Vice President Joe Biden might not have to worry about getting back to the White House, even if he doesn't get the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Apparently, Kamala Harris says that Joe Biden would be a great VP for her. Zach, any chance at all that Joe Biden would be anyone's running mate again?
I mean, turnabout's fair play. So I appreciate the sentiment, but I think this is Joe's final act. I can't see him going in for another VP role. I mean, you know, anything's possible. I've learned in the last few years that I don't know as much about politics as I think I do. So I'd never say never. but I would be really surprised if Joe at this point, you know, would be willing to step back and be a second banana in another administration.
And Carla, I mean, just thinking about Kamala Harris just saying it out loud, I mean, that took a little bit of guts to say that.
A little pointed humor on her part. And, you know, a lot of people were saying, hey, it's sexist for all the women candidates to be mentioned as VPs. She got back there on that, and I think she gets some points for throwing some humor out there.
Zach Corser is visiting assistant professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico's California Playbook. Have a great weekend, you two.
You too. Have a great weekend.
All right, extending the statute of limitations to prosecute domestic violence from 3 to 10 years. We're going to hear that argument coming up when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Oh, what's good, L.A.?
I'm Bruce Lemon, host of Unheard L.A., KPCC In-Person's live storytelling series. Our show is real people amplified, so turn your speakers up a little bit and listen to this clip.
At 4:31 a.m., we were awakened by the violent shaking of the Northridge earthquake. I was alive and very unhappy about it.
Join us for a live show on Sunday, May 19th at the Aritani Theater in Little Tokyo. RSVP at kpcc.org/unheardla.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. In October 2015, SoCalGas discovered a leak in its Aliso Canyon storage field. The natural gas leak lasted for several months and forced thousands of residents in nearby Porter Ranch to evacuate. Well, the report is finally out that explains what caused the leak and why it took so long to stop it. KPCC's infrastructure reporter Sharon McNary has been following the Aliso Canyon gas leak investigation. She joins us now to break down the findings. Hello, Sharon.
Hey there.
All right, we waited 3 years for this report from the California Public Utilities Commission. What does it tell us?
The big takeaway from this report, and it was produced by an independent scientific analysis firm, is that this well lacked some basic protection from groundwater and that eventually caused it to fail. But the report also says there were things that the gas field owner, Southern California Gas Company, could or should have done to prevent the leak, detect it earlier, respond to it better, and shorten the four-month duration of the blowout.
Now, this report gets into the nitty-gritty details, but what's the big takeaway on why the well failed?
So this is a 52-year-old well. It should have had cement sealing the metal casing away from the corrosive dirt and rock outside of it. But the top 440 feet of this well did not have that outer cement layer. That meant the water could touch the outer metal surface of the casing and potentially corrode it and get into the well. And that's what happened. Think of a gas well as kind of a straw within a straw within a straw. Over the years, groundwater got into that space between the outermost straw, the casing, and the 7-inch inner casing of the well. There, microbes fed on carbon dioxide, and together they corroded the 7-inch inner tubing. So on October 23rd, 2015, while gas was being injected at very high pressure, it broke open that 7-inch metal tube, and gas escaped through the corroded outer casing up where the cement was missing.
Now, this well was leaking for more than 100 days, despite attempts to stop it. Why did it take so long to stop?
SoCalGas did call on the nation's top well blowout experts, but over 7 attempts to kill the well, stop the escaping gas, over 2 months, none worked. The gas flow eventually stopped after 111 days by drilling a second well to intercept the leaking well thousands of feet below the surface. So those 7 well kill attempts, they basically pump heavy fluids at high pressure into the well bore hole. They can also load it with what they call junk, things like golf balls, to also try and stop the blowout. This report says that to kill the well, SoCalGas should have used higher density fluids and higher pressures. But the company had not correctly estimated how fast or hard the gas was flowing to calculate those right pressures.
So what's larger procedural issues that Aliso Canyon does the report outline?
This is where the report gets into how SoCalGas was running the gas storage field. For starters, it was somebody from a completely different company, Termo Oil, who notified SoCalGas that their gas well was leaking. And SoCalGas went out and said, we don't detect a leak. So the report says SoCalGas did not have the kind of daily surveillance to detect leaks early. Also, the company did not investigate previous casing failures in dozens of other wells over the years. They also had not done the kind of risk assessment needed to understand and prevent this kind of blowout.
All right, one more thing, Sharon. Now that the report is finished and all done, should we expect changes from SoCalGas that could prevent similar situations in the future?
Well, the company, as well as its state regulators, have already made a ton of changes. Each of the areas where SoCalGas fell short of following best practices in its operation of the gas field are now covered in the rules. Each of the 114 wells at Aliso has either been shut down or completely overhauled, so about 64 wells are in operation now. But there are still calls to close Aliso completely. For its part, SoCalGas says it complied with the regulations that existed at the time, and that it didn't find indications that the well casing was corroded, using the methods that they were supposed to be using at the time.
That's KPCC infrastructure reporter Sharon McNary telling us about a new report detailing the reasons for the Aliso Canyon natural gas leak near Porter Ranch. Sharon, thank you very much.
You bet.
Moving on, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than one in three women and one in four men in the United States have experienced rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner. In California, the statute of limitations for prosecuting domestic violence as a felony is about 3 years. But a new bill introduced by State Senator Susan Rubio of the San Gabriel Valley would push that to 10 years in some cases.
Some of us get there sooner, some of us take a little longer, but either way, we want to give women the opportunity and the time to heal, find their voice, and have the courage to come forward and seek justice.
That's Senator Rubio speaking to my colleague, All Things Considered host Nick Roman, about Senate Bill 273. Elaine Whitefeather is a victims advocate who founded a domestic violence crisis center in Sacramento called Communities for Peace. She testified on behalf of the legislation recently. Elaine Whitefeather, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Now, Elaine, before we get to the bill, tell me a little bit about your organization and why you started it.
Well, I've been a domestic violence advocate for almost 40 years. So since before even domestic violence was criminalized in the United States, I began work because I am also a survivor. We started a Community for Peace. I actually was hired as a consultant to develop the organization. And so we are now a state and county certified organization. However, I think we're a little bit different because we are very grassroots, meaning that almost 80 to 85% of my staff and board of directors are survivors of intimate partner violence and domestic violence.
Yeah, Elaine, and you mentioned how you're a victim of domestic violence. Can you tell us a little bit more, if it's okay, about your story?
Like many of us, we are born into a home where there is abuse. And so I am a survivor of sexual assault. I am a survivor of domestic violence as a child, as a young adult, sadly, and as an adult. And that is actually the typical story of someone who is traumatized early in life. The development of your own brain changes, and so it attacks so much of your whole sense of self-value and worth.
Now, about the legislation by Senator Rubio, she wants to extend the period during which crimes of domestic violence can be reported and prosecuted. Why is this important in your view, Elaine?
Well, it's understanding the trauma of domestic violence. I think we can call it domestic violence. I think these days in the movement, we like to also maybe highlight that it's intimate partner violence. So this is violence by somebody you love. It is not one incident of assault. It is an environment of coercion. It is an environment of power and control. It's an environment of oppression. So victims of domestic violence struggle with developing, you know, new coping skills or managing their lives, their children escaping, surviving, healing, thriving. All of these things have to happen. It takes a number of years for these things to happen. And so by the time we're in the middle of thawing out, numbing out that we have to do to cope with it, that statute of limitations is already over.
So it's fair to say then, Elaine, that someone needs a lot more time to get traumatic memories like this in order to be able to say, hey, that's a crime, I need to report this. It can't just happen in the moment.
Yes. And the thing about it is, too, that in these relationships, you are also being brainwashed about who not to call. Law enforcement is number one. And if you are from a marginalized and a community of color, you already have culturally a barrier to some of these systems.
We're talking to Elaine Whitefeather. She's a victims advocate who founded a domestic violence crisis center in Sacramento called Communities for Peace. Now, Elaine, the legislation has had some challenges on its journey. Initially,
yes,
the senator wanted to get rid of the statute entirely at one point. Then she wanted to expand the statute of limitations to 20 years. Now it's only 10 years if certain criteria apply. I'm wondering, Elaine, does that frustrate you at all that it's gone back and forth like this?
Well, I guess because I've been in it 40 years, no, I think it's part of the process. Change is hard. And if you have not been through it as a survivor, it's hard for everyday people to understand, how do people you love do this to you? So it's hard to get it. So as much as I agree that it should not even have a statute of limitation or a 20-year one, I will take the 10 with gratitude that that is a step. And then you provide the evidence that that is effective, that the folks who do then come in have the time. You will probably have greater opportunities for actual charges to be filed, for successful prosecutions to take place, less recanting of stories. And maybe that's the evidence that will allow us to expand it to 15.
You know, my colleague here at KPCC, Nick Roman, asked this question of the senator. So I'm going to ask you the same question.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen issues with the statute of limitations come up in several high-profile cases involving the Me Too movement. But domestic violence hasn't come up as much in those conversations. Elaine, why do you think that is? And is it time for this issue to have its own hashtag Me Too movement as well?
Sexual assault, even when most cases sexual assault is by somebody that you know, is very different than when you are in the relationship, a committed, what you think is a loving relationship. This abuse takes place over time. This is not what you know going into the relationship. This is not the way it's presented to you. So you are groomed into this. You fall in love like anyone else does. It's love that bonds us, that becomes love that binds us. And so we don't talk about it.
Now, the other part of Senator Rubio's legislation involves police training. Existing law already requires law enforcement to develop guidelines for responding to domestic violence cases. Elaine, what can you tell us about the course of training this bill calls for and why it's an important part of the whole package?
Well, I'll have a caveat to the training part because I know law enforcement gets domestic violence and ITV training in their post-training. I do know that. However, their whole perspective and lens, of course, as it should be, is justice, as in criminal. And so if you could get a training that was comprehensive, that was not just law enforcement training law enforcement, that is not going to work out good,
well,
I can tell you that.
It definitely sounds like if victims were involved in the training, that the training might be more effective.
It will be. I'm even actually trying to work on right now with my team to develop a video for training for law enforcement that's called Inside Out. Here's the questions we wish you would have asked us. Here's what we wish you would have paid attention to, you know, for Child Protective Services, too. So I understand their perspective of not having to repeat, you know, going to the same call over and over again will be lessened. So I understand their frustration, but their solution can't be them helping themselves.
And you mentioned how police would be better informed on what to ask when they arrive to situations like this. But when it comes to domestic violence, there's so many variables for an officer when they arrive at the scene. This kind of training, would it also help them make it a safer encounter for them as well?
Absolutely, it would. And I know that for a fact in the work that we did with the Citrus Heights Police Department from 2009 to probably 2016 or so. And it was actually cited by Senator Feinstein as the way to do community policing. It is one of the most dangerous calls a law enforcement officer can respond to. And it is one of the most frustrating calls for them. And I think that this will indeed reduce that, create safety for them, help them to identify the type of abuser, who's more likely to have a weapon. These are all the things we were able to help law enforcement. And they had such a great success rate doing it.
Elaine, before we let you go, if someone's listening and wondering why it would be important to push that statute of limitations up to 10 years, what would be the one thing you would say to convince them that this is something that's needed?
Because every single one of us in the United States of America, and especially here in California, knows a victim and a survivor of domestic violence. Our silence doesn't mean we aren't here.
Elaine Whitefeather is a victims advocate who founded a domestic violence crisis center in Sacramento called Communities for Peace. She's talking with us about new legislation that would expand the statute of limitations for prosecuting crimes of domestic violence. Elaine, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right, you know the saying, your home is your castle. Well, back in the 40s and 50s, California had lots of space for people to customize their castles any way they wanted. And it was around that time that a unique home design started popping up. It started up north, but made its way down to Southern California. Only four areas. Coming up, a tour of the home building legacy and style of Joseph Eichler. That's ahead when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. An online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start in September. Apply by May 28th for a $1,500 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Between 1944 and 1966, real estate developer Joseph Eichler became known for his distinctive mid-century modern tract housing. And this weekend, Preserve Orange County is hosting a tour of seven Eichler homes that showcase the legacy of his style right here in Southern California. For a preview, I paid a visit to the Fair Hills Tract in Orange yesterday. It's one of the three Eichler developments in the city. Robert Imboden, owner of the Janus Historic Preservation Consulting Firm, was my guide, and I met him at his own Eichler home, and then together we drove in the rain to tour one of the neighborhood's newly restored homes.
Now, an Eichler home. We're driving through a neighborhood of Eichler homes. What do they look like? What's their big characteristic, at least on the outside?
Well, from the street, they tend to be very closed off. That's a characteristic that's very common with them. So they're very, very private from the street. You have very few windows. It's at the rear of the house and both the interior atrium where you have this expansive use of floor-to-ceiling glass, which really makes the houses very, very transparent, while at the same time they're very private from the street and to their neighbors.
All right, Robert, so we pulled up to a pretty classic example of an Eichler home. And yeah, you're right. I mean, there's windows at the top of it, but it's definitely not something that anyone could look through. You'd have to have a ladder, and then you'd have the cops probably called on you. And it's definitely long to the eye. So it's not one of these things where you can kind of eyeball it straight ahead and get the full picture. You almost have to run your eyes across it because it's so long from the street.
The homes are very, very horizontal in their orientation. You know, I think we can look at the extensive use of single-story development as also being a way that Eichler was delivering really medium-priced homes to the middle classes. Two-story construction always costs more than single-story, so certainly that has something to do with it as well.
And before we go into this house, Joseph Eichler was not an architect. He was a real estate developer.
It's a common misconception because we always refer to these homes as Eichler homes. So no, Eichler was a developer. He had a business background, and about midway through his career, he left that and just out on a whim developed a small residential development in 1945, and over the next 20 years, he ended up producing over 11,000 residential living units.
Do we know why he likes this particular style? Did he get with designers?
He does. He had a number of architects that work for him over the years. There are three primary firms, the first being Anshin and Allen, who were his exclusive architects for a number of years. Then he brought in a Los Angeles firm of Jones and Emmons. They also became quite prominent within Eichler's work. And then just at the time that the Fairhaven tract here in Orange was built, Anshin and Allen both retired from their firm, and the associate in their office, Claude Oakland, who had been working on the Eichler projects in the office, went on his own, and he continued to work with Eichler for the next several years, building more of these homes. So it just so happens that here in Orange, we have the last of the Anshin and Allen homes for Eichler, and then we have both Jones and Emmons and Claude Oakland represented as well.
All these features that you mentioned, this privacy from the street, not being able to look in the atrium before the house opens up, well, that's stuff that Southern California homeowners wanted at the time.
They are homes that only work in this climate. And is that something that people wanted? Well, certain people. The homes were, particularly when they were first offered, they were often bought by architects or designers, people working in the aerospace industry. These are people who post-war were very progressive people working in progressive industries, and they wanted to surround themselves in a home that also was progressive and forward-thinking.
All right, let's go inside this
one. Okay, let's go look.
So, there we go. Step on in.
So again, you have this compression of space here,
yeah,
and then this release when you walk into the atrium that's open to the sky. And of course, here today it's raining, so we have rain falling into the middle of the house.
So it's the feeling of being outdoors when you're indoors.
Yeah, and of course, there's all these sliding doors that open onto the atrium space so that you literally can open the house to the exterior. So I think one of the things you notice first when you walk in is the post and beam construction. It's one of the things that helps these houses be unique. Rather than using a series of conventionally framed walls, it's a series of posts with beams that span. What that means is the wall can be glass, it can be solid, it can be whatever you need it to be, wherever you need it to be, because the roof is not held up by a series of load-bearing walls.
But typically, it's glass, right, for an Eichler home?
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Because, I mean, as much glass as possible, particularly at the rear of the home. Again, you see the mahogany paneling that's used extensively in the public areas of the home. When you get into the bedrooms and the hallways, the more private places, the paneling is not used there.
And right off the bat, too, from the time we entered, if we stood at the front door, we could see all the way through the house. We wouldn't have to go past any walls to see from one end to the other, all
exactly.
the way through.
Exactly. They're very dramatic houses, right? As soon as you open that entry door, you can immediately see all the way through the house to the rear, as well as when you're in the house, you can see through the atrium to the other rooms inside the house because there is so much glazing.
Robert, we're standing right in the middle of this Eichler home, but what would you say? What would be the one thing, the aesthetic that really stands out about an Eichler home, a typical Eichler home?
I think in these homes, you can say that it imbues the automobile culture at the time. Not this model that I've been showing you, but you saw the carports on all the others. So it's not just a carport on the side of the house. Eichler has a carport right at the entry of the house. You have to walk past that car to get to the front door. Then the garages are covered with this siding. I mean, the garage doors, who does that? There's different ways of looking at that Eichler was either trying to say, well, we have to have the garage, so let's make it look like part of the house. Or you can look at it like, no, you're bringing the car right into the house. It's living in the house with you. So there's that aspect of it. There's also, we talk about mid-century design, that there's a sense of liberation. There's a sense of excitement and anticipation and optimism for the future. This is post-war. We have now all of these new materials that have come out of the war. The economy is booming like never before. And so there's a certain exuberance that exists within culture, and that's reflected in the architectures. It's largely an open floor plan, which again is something that we take for granted today. But in the 1960s, that was still quite progressive to have this open of a floor plan.
It definitely is a plan here, because so in the common areas, which would be the living room, the kitchen, the atrium, it's very open and spacious. But now that we're getting into the private areas, the bedrooms, all of a sudden things close up a bit.
Bedrooms were for sleeping in. So why do they need to be large? Why do we need to put more attention there than necessary, right? The majority of time that we're in the bedroom, we're asleep and we have our eyes closed. So put the emphasis out here where you live. And that was, I think, really the genesis. The bedrooms are not large at all in Eichler homes.
So Robert, what do you have going on this weekend with Eichler Homes?
Preserve Orange County, which is a countywide organization that's focused on historic properties and sites, we're hosting one of our first programming events, and that is an Eichler home tour. It features 7 homes throughout the 3 tracks in Orange and is also representative of all 3 architects. There have been a few Eichler home tours in the past, but of course the homes were just designated as historic resources in December, so this is really their debut as a historic home tour, if you will, and it's a much larger, more complex tour than what we've seen in the past for these homes.
That's Robert Imboden, owner of Janus, a historic preservation consulting firm. Robert, thank you very much for having us out here at an Eichler home.
Thank you for coming down.
All right, I got on the Game of Thrones train late. When I started here in 2012, Monday mornings, I'd see and hear people gather in corners, whispering about what happened on the show the night before. So I felt left out. I decided to watch. I binged a few seasons, got caught up. Now it's ending. If you want to share the joy or anger of who winds up on the Iron Throne with other fans, we'll tell you where to go when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. If you were planning on going to the third annual Cuban American Music Festival this Sunday in Los Angeles, don't. It's been postponed due to the threat of rain. It'll now happen on June 30th at La Plaza de Cultura y Artes in downtown. Now, over the past decade, Los Angeles has seen a steady arrival of Cuban musicians who've integrated into the salsa and Cuban music scenes. Many of these musicians play in multiple bands across the LA area. As Take Two contributor Beto Arcos reports, their presence has enriched the music community and helped turn LA into a powerhouse of Latin music.
Calixto Oviedo and Lily Hernandez are a husband and wife Cuban music team. He's a percussionist, she's a singer, and together they play in no less than 10 Cuban and salsa bands, including three of their own. I caught them on a Saturday night playing with their group Son Sabroso Quartet at the Madre restaurant in Torrance. Oviedo and Hernandez moved to LA from Denver 5 years ago. Hernandez says they're very happy they moved here.
At the beginning, when we were in Europe, we were thinking about Miami. And yeah. Everybody was like, no, are you crazy? Miami, no, you're going to be one more, you know, one more Cuban. And it was like, okay, it's like Cuban. I don't care. I want to go there. But, you know, the destiny says, no Miami, Denver, and then L.A.
In addition to the bands, Oviedo teaches drums and percussion at Cal State L.A.'s music department. Oviedo says L.A. has given them and other Cuban musicians many opportunities to find work.
Our work in Los Angeles is well respected, and modestly speaking, we are in great demand, and that's comforting and feels good.
The nine-piece band La Charanga Cubana plays every Saturday at the Palms restaurant in Downey. That's where I talked to Dennis Medina, who plays tres guitar, an essential instrument in traditional Cuban music. He moved to L.A. in 2015 and now plays with five different Cuban and salsa bands. Medina says he learned about the music scene through Facebook and started to look for bands and found out there was also Cuban music in L.A. That's how he found La Charanga Cubana.
La Charanga del Maestro Edgar Hernandez.
La Charanga Cubana's director is Edgar Hernandez. He founded the group in 1997 and was nominated for a Latin Grammy in 2007. Hernandez says when he first arrived in L.A. from Mexico in the mid-90s, Cuban bands were almost non-existent. He says a lot has changed since then. Hernandez says now he can see a lot of movement of Cuban music in the area and appreciates it, because that's what he's been fighting for from the beginning, and he's finally seeing the fruits today. He says the doors opened and he now sees that something beautiful is happening.
Why do immigrants move to another place? They will never have the opportunities that they will see in countries like this in their own places. That's the basics of the immigration wave.
That's Guido Herrera, one of the hosts of the weekend program Alma del Barrio on KXLU, and a salsa and Cuban music promoter.
And I think that one musician came to Los Angeles, whoever that was, and then his friend. So I assume that one came, and the other came behind him, and the other came behind him. And we have a great group of young musicians from Cuba in Los Angeles.
A couple weeks ago, I went to see five Cuban musicians who were jamming at the home of trumpet player Leider Chapotin. Bass player Azaris Manuel moved to L.A. 5 years ago after living 15 years in Milan, Italy. He currently plays in five Cuban and salsa bands. He says over the past 60 years, Cuban music has suffered from isolation due to the U.S. embargo.
La música cubana es muy extensa.
He says for a long time, Cuban music has been marginalized. Cuban music is vast with many genres and types of music, and now is the time to bring all that music back. Last Saturday, I went to see Calixto Oviedo and Lily Hernandez Orquesta at El Floridita in Hollywood. They played a set of all kinds of Cuban dance music, son, cha-cha-cha, and timba, which is a more complex style of Cuban dance music, rumba and son mixed with funk. Oviedo, who is one of the creators of the timba sound, says that even with a bigger presence of Cuban musicians in L.A., The music has yet to be fully embraced by club owners and promoters who still prefer the more traditional salsa, music made famous by singers like Celia Cruz.
It's difficult to play Cuban music because there's still a lot of taboos. They say, don't play timba, play salsa. And what is salsa? What are we talking about? What did Celia Cruz sing? La sopita en botella? Cucala? Cuban tunes written by Cubans and performed by a Cuban?
But he says he's been able to prove that there's an appetite for something different.
When our band plays at El Floridita or the Granada, which is a tough venue, where people go to dance to Celia Cruz, Cheo Feliciano, and Mark Anthony, and we play timba, people go wild and they shout at Lily, another one.
At the end, they have to do what the public want, and the public want to dance here in Los Angeles.
Salsa and Cuban music promoter Guido Herrera.
But when they start creating their own music and their own sound, yes, definitely will enrich what we already have, that's for sure.
The word is out that Cuban music is alive and thriving in L.A. Percussionist Calixto Oviedo says his music friends in New York have commented on the vibrant Latin music scene here.
Los Angeles has turned into a very big place for Latin music. The city of music was always New York, and it will always be, but L.A. is now the competition. Truly, L.A. is now in competition with any city in the U.S.
Today, in the L.A. area, there are up to 20 Cuban and more than 30 salsa bands. It's fair to say Los Angeles can give New York a run for its money. For Take Two, I'm Beto Arcos.
All right, finally, the weekend's almost here, and we have some ideas for what you can do.
Hi, I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. Yes, there might be rain in the forecast for Sunday, but that won't stop you from getting out to enjoy SoCal, right?
Right. And this flea market I found is, well, a little odd, but proud of it. The Oddities Flea Market takes over the Globe Theater in downtown LA tomorrow and Sunday. The Brooklyn-based bazaar offers items like medical history collectibles, bone specimens, taxidermy items, eclectic home decor, jewelry, and other unclassifiable stuff. It's a popular event, so you'll have better chances of scoring tickets for Sunday. Admission ranges from $10 to $40.
Also this weekend, you like tacos, don't you? Of course, everyone does. You're an Angelino. But you don't really love tacos unless you have some with escamoles. That, my adventurous friend, is ant larva. Yes, I'm very serious about this. Eating it is more common in and around Mexico City, but this weekend, Chef Fernando Villa Gomez has imported some for a four-course tasting menu in Venice. There are three nights to choose from, tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday, and the price is $50.
Celebrate the written word at LitFest Pasadena tomorrow and Sunday. It features more than 200 authors doing dozens of readings, panels, podcast tapings, signings, and performances. The festival covers most genres from sci-fi to true crime, poetry, black literature, and local media. LitFest is also dedicated to the late food critic Jonathan Gold, who was the festival's co-founder. And so it wraps on Sunday with the program How Jonathan Gold Reinvented Los Angeles. The LA Times' Laura Ochoa gathers friends and former colleagues to reminisce and remember her late husband. Expect laughs, maybe some tears, and lots of food talk. LitFest is completely free.
Finally, this Sunday night is the finale of Game of Thrones. Actually, I can hear some of you groan through the radio. Yeah, I know. I read the books and only started watching recently, but no matter how you feel about this past season, you gotta find out how it ends, right? So do it in a group setting at a watch party. One to highlight happens in the freshly reopened Hotel Figueroa in downtown LA. They'll serve special themed items like little fingerling potatoes and the open faceless man sandwich, plus drinks like Stark Courage. Just head to their event space called Tangier, and entry is free. Now, there's actually so much more to do than just that. You can find our whole list of events on LAist.com. That is LAIST.com.
I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. And
see you later. Have a good weekend, everyone.
All right, that's it for Take Two this week. The show was edited by Sue Carpenter. Our producers are Austin Cross, Lori Skywalker Galaretta, and Leo Duran. The last two also directed the show this week. Emily Henderson helped out with production. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice. The program is engineered by Hasmik Pogosian. Our senior producer is Megan Larson. Still got that poll up on my Twitter page at amartinezla. Who winds up on the Iron Throne? No one. No one so far thinks Danny is going to wind up on the Iron Throne. Michelle Faust Raghavan, our healthcare reporter, thinks it's going to be Arya. Arya Stark. That's her vote so far. So vote on the poll. A Martinez LA. That's A Martinez LA. And you can find Take Two on Twitter as well at Take Two. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.